Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
Hi, folks. It's a double week. I mean, it's been quite a lot of double weeks this year so far, hasn't it? So I should say a special thank you to my lovely Ben, who is my rock when it comes to all things soundtracking. Welcome along to another episode. How are you? I hope this finds you well. I have been on the radio this week, but I've also been in to see quite a few films. Really early doors, so early in fact that I am NDA'd up to the max and I can't talk about anything. But let me just say that yesterday and today I saw two absolute crackers of films that I really hope I get the chance to talk to some of the people behind them for the film. One of them, they've already appeared on the podcast twice, and the other one, I don't think I've had them on. The director. Writer-director, anyway. That's by the by. Shall we talk about the now? Because our latest guest on soundtracking is finally Michael Pearce, which is, in fact, an interview that we premiered on our YouTube channel, Soundtracking Extra, which you can still find there if you want to watch it, along with loads of exclusive content and video versions of the podcast. So please do go and check it out and subscribe if you fancy it. Also, I'd really love to hear from you guys. I'd really like you to just tell me about films that you've watched or what you've liked, what you've not liked, whether that be at the cinema or on streaming. Doesn't have to be all about new releases. Just something you've watched that you want to say something about. The email is info@edithbowman.com, and I'd really like to try and get into a regular thing of every week sort of sharing people's thoughts about various films that they've watched. So please do get in touch, info@edithbowman.com. But Michael Pearce is wicked. I first came across his work for his film Beast with Johnny Flynn and one of my favourites, Jesse Buckley. But he's most recently directed the Apple TV Plus film, Echo Valley. So I really wanted to share our chat on the main podcast because I think he's such great value, as is this film. Now, Echo Valley stars Julianne Moore and Sydney Sweeney, and it tells the story of Julianne's character, who's the mother, who comes to the aid of her daughter, played by Sydney, when she turns up in somewhat of an alarming state. I'm not going to go into any great detail about the film. There's a little few bit of spoiler bits in the interview and stuff. So maybe if you haven't seen it yet, go and check it out. It's all up on Apple TV Plus now. It's scored by Jed Carzo. And I actually spoke to Jed just the other morning. We recorded an episode. He was in Australia. So I'm going to share that with you over the next couple of weeks. He also did the score for Tornado that you guys know that I loved. But we are going to kick off with one of Jed's cues from Echo Valley. This is Diving.
Thank you. So, how are you?
Good. It looks like I'm in a very fancy hotel room. People might think that this is my living room or something.
You've beat me because I'm at Didcot Parkway train station. Glamour! Listen, congratulations on this film. It's kind of weird because I don't want to go too into kind of too much detail on it because the experience of the film and kind of the twists and turns and where it takes you is such part of the experience of watching the film. But needless to say, it was just an amazing experience. It's not often you're surprised like that at a cinema. So I absolutely loved it. How was the story presented to you and what was it about it that you were kind of interested in bringing your vision to it?
It was what they call an ODA, open directing assignment. So it's a script that goes out and then, you know, a few directors pitch on it. And I got it through scot-free and I met those guys after I did my first film and we were looking to do something together. And it was partly what you just said. It was that I couldn't predict it. And, you know, with a crime thriller, sometimes as an audience member, when you're reading something, you feel like you want to be able to beat the script or you want to outsmart it and see where it's going. And I just couldn't with this one. But it didn't felt like it was, it felt genuine, the twist that it took, you know, and it was always rooted in character. And so I felt like I was in really good hands in terms of Brad being a storyteller. So there was that kind of sense of just being riveted by it. Also, the combination of it being a really tense crime thriller, but having characters in a world that I believed in and that there were themes that were rich and knotty. And there was like genuine ethical dilemmas to be invested in. And I find it hard to get a script that has all of these things like theme, character, a great story engine, twists that you can't see coming, like really, really rare. So I read it in one sitting really quickly and then threw my hat in the ring to get it.
What does that involve? What does throwing your hat in the ring involve? Are you storyboards? Are you kind of mood boards? What's the...
It's more a conversation. I think maybe other directors do that. I think at the beginning, it had a conversation with the producer and with Brad, who wrote the script, and just, talking through my reaction to the story and what I thought, what it was really about. And it was how you articulate that, what you want to protect when you bring it to the screen, where you think it might need further development. And you're just candid with the whole thing, you know, and, you know, you win or lose, I suppose, that, you know, based on just how much you're in sync, you know, are you in the same frequency as the writer and producers? And I cannot remember what I said because it's probably like 2.5, 3.5 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, but whatever I said, it must have resonated with them. But it's a couple of conversations, you know, and then all the pictures and the mood and that's, you know, maybe you reference a couple of movies on a call, but I think all of that comes later. It's really your reaction to the story.
When do you start thinking about music? Like when you're writing a script?
It's always been much later for me. It's when I get into the edit. I'd love to go through a process where I'm working with a composer who's started as we're shooting, but I just haven't, it usually doesn't work out the timings of that. So it's later and maybe because I can't play an instrument, I'd be hesitant to dictate too specifically like, oh, this is what it is. This one is like freeform jazz. I just know this is going to work. You know, maybe I'll have that, but it's really in conversation with the composer, you know, and I've worked with Jed twice now and it's showing images to him and me not saying too much and seeing what his ideas are, because I also don't want to color his experience or for him to be hemmed into a particular lane.
I actually just did an event on Friday with John McLean for Tornado that Jed did. So, I mean, his scores are phenomenal, you know. It's kind of just, and it's interesting because I kind of get the impression that with every project, kind of the project and the time frame kind of dictates as I'm when, at what point of the process he gets involved sort of thing as well. But what were the kind of conversations that you had with him? Did you give him any kind of like, not reference points, but themes and things that you wanted him to lean into or steer away from really?
That's what I've worked with him, you know, the second time as well as the first. They're both genre films to a certain degree, but we've always wanted to have the kind of aesthetic fingerprint of the music to not go into an obvious direction. So sometimes it's a bit of negation, just like what we don't want it to be. And we were like, let's not make a score that's too pastoral or starts with kind of like melodic guitar. And Jed likes to respond a lot to a landscape and see and how, and it's interesting to see how that influences, you know, the instrumentation. And with this, he was just watching it, and he particularly the lake as well as the farm, but he really loved the idea of using, yeah, organic instruments that have a very rustic quality to them, and then having, you know, sort of disrupting that electronically underneath. And he liked the idea that you have this kind of beautiful lake where families go, but actually under the surface is where bodies could be dumped and things might resurface. And there was something in that similar thing with the relationship where these two women that are a bit broken in different ways put on the facade of wholesomeness when they first meet each other, but very quickly that becomes quite brittle and then there's cracks in it. So I think, you know, that's what thematically that was part of the conversation, the landscape, and then this mother-daughter relationship. Also, we talked more like from a macro perspective of just across the whole film, we sometimes needed a very sensitive approach to the music, and it needed to be very delicate, almost fragile, and it could sort of fall apart. And then other times it needed to be very sort of muscular and big and visceral and discordant and jarring. And so and then it becomes a judgment as you're putting in music into the film, like, is there, you want to hold enough in the tank that you've got something left in the climax. And that's more just about listening to the whole score in the movie. So it's lots of different versions of conversations depending on where we are in the process.
It's so true, because I think with this film particularly, in terms of, you've almost got to betray us as the audience in a way with certain things, you know, in terms of whether it's situations or relationships sort of thing as well. That's the kind of, I think, the really clever thing about all the PCs within this film, you know, in terms of where we go, oh, you know, and then you go, oh, you know, it's kind of like, it's so, so clever. And particularly with music, because it can so easily tell you so much before something's happened or tell you where you're headed. And I think that it's just done so well in this, in terms of, yeah, it's kind of slightly deceitful in a way. It's brilliant.
I think sometimes music's a way to also, you get to thread the whole movie together. You know, like I remember in a climactic scene near the end, because Jed came onto this late, we were working with a different composer, and for like personal reasons, we had to like part ways, someone I really admire. And I, the first person I thought of when we didn't work together was Jed. And so there was already a very sort of developed edit, and we were working with some temp. And like any composer, that's, there's maybe something good about that because it can articulate something where a director doesn't have a musical language or vernacular, but it's also, it can get in the way very, very quickly. But Jed's very good at sort of going, okay, there's something interesting here, and then just pushing aside other bits of temp score and going, there's just, we can do better than that. Let's just move on from that. But I think at the in the this climactic scene we had, and I think it's known by film composers as the Forbidden Cue. It's Journey to the Line by Hans Zimmer. That was in Thin Red Line. It's very big, and but it kind of nearly always works when you put it on something. And he watched
Yeah.
the film and he was like, oh God, you've put that cue on. And I was like, no, just ignore it, just ignore it. But then it was like this shadow that kind of cut. So he kind of left that cue near the end. And we weren't sure, he wasn't sure what the approach was going to be, but he knew he needed to kind of trumpet, but also in a totally different way. But what he did in this climactic sequence was he was using elements from lots of tracks that had already been used in the film. He kind of waited near the end to attack that track, but he'd already created such a rich palette of sounds and music. It was like the whole sort of mosaic coming together. And then when you're repeating certain sounds and motifs and certain bits of instrumentation, there's it feels like the film as a whole.
What about when it comes to needle drops? If it's existing music that either you're using in a film just as a piece of score or diegetically that it features within a scene. I've heard so many different variations of that. Of the one that really sticks in my mind, which I still can't get my head around, is the dance scene from Napoleon Dynamite where he dances to Canned Heat, and how they filmed that to a completely different song. And that blows my mind, because you're going, surely he's dancing to that piece of music. And it's like, it's crazy to think that he wasn't, because it fits so brilliantly. There's quite a few pieces of music in the film, you know, whether it's Carly Simon or Fleetwood Mac or Etta James. Were any of those written in Brad's script?
No, they were all found all in you. The edit. Yeah, except for when Julie and Fiona danced to Robin.
Yeah, dancing on my own, what a tune, man.
Yeah, and we were kind of hesitant about that, because it'd been used in films before, and you know, everyone knows it so well, and it's probably been on adverts, and we're like, is it overexposed? But then when we tried out, we did in the edit try and look at other tracks, and we were like, it just doesn't work as well. There was something, we kind of wanted something that felt familiar, because it couldn't be so, we didn't want to signal that, you know, Julie's character was a music buff, and the latest thing. It kind of had to be, you know, something that you'd like, but also your parents have danced to. And I think that was the only one. There was more, I think, when I first read the script, actually, when Julie's character listens to, she's got her headphones in, she used to listen to music. Mm-hmm. And so music played a bigger part.
But interesting.
It felt too much like music was almost playing too big a part, and it was kind of pivoting the film in all these different directions. So it was only when we're in the edit that we landed on this idea that she was actually listening to voicemails from her partner. And that, I'd never had that before, where like a kind of revelation like that, where you'd quite become quite a big change from the material shots to how it's portrayed then in the film. So we ended up taking music out that was in the script and replacing it with these voicemails.
What did they dance to, though, for that? When you were filming it for the one you used Robin at, did you have music?
No, that was Robin.
Okay,
that was
Robin.
Yeah, they danced that. On set. And you know, I'm yet to meet an actor that loves to do a dance scene.
Really?
Well, I think if you're rehearsing them very specifically, then that could be fun.
Yeah.
But if it's something like this, and we spoke about how do we need to rehearse it? It shouldn't feel like, we don't want choreographed moves. And that made sense. But when it comes to the day, suddenly you haven't, you know, it's not, they've had zero beers. It's daytime. They have a whole film crew watching them. Suddenly it dawns on the actors, like, oh, shit, we haven't choreographed this. But they quickly, as soon as you play Robin out loud, everyone's good. Somebody said you got a new friend. Does she love you better than?
Film is incredible. Donald Gleason, man, oh my god,
he's such a nice guy in real life.
I know, I did a thing with him about a month ago. You know, he's quite nervous, he's like, I don't really like talking, and then we had such a nice time, and he's just so lovely and easy and funny. And then I saw him in this and I was like, Jesus,
yeah,
he's a good actor.
Yeah, I found that when we do costume fittings, I would look at photos of him in outfit, and there was just something weird and off about him. He's kind of creepy, even just posing. He was trying to find the character, and we did camera
hair.
Of it's the hair.
Yeah,
Yeah, and that it's a kind of similar tone to his skin tone, and yeah, it's kind of uncanny how such a sweet-natured person can really quickly just he looks a different way. Yeah, it was great building the character with him. I think that was one thing that me and Brad continued to develop when I came onto the script, that I think the character was a tiny bit more archetypal of a bad guy, and he had tattoos and muscles, and there was a swagger. And I said, oh, maybe we should find an actor that isn't going to lean into that. Maybe we should go a different direction. And the character, it's not about how he throws his weight around so much, but it's about what's motivating him. He's this very serpentine figure that, like a snake, spots a vulnerable animal, and kind of coils itself around them. Donal was great just in terms of the collaboration. He's asking all the right questions, like, well, what's really motivating him? It's not money. Is this some kind of strange revenge from being rejected by this family? And he looked for opportunities of humor. Like, I think some of the best jokes in the movie are from him sort of ad-libbing and improvising them. And he liked this idea that he would mispronounce words. So he was always trying to give the impression that he was smarter than he actually is. And so there's all these little nuances and details going through the script with Donal that you just kept on going over and over again, and you'd find new opportunities to sort of dimensionalize the character a bit more. So it was really great working with him. Oh, I think you might be on mute.
I was just trying to avoid you hearing all the trains
Oh.
passing. Julianne Moore is Julianne Moore. I mean, she's just, again, this film, and you feel like you've given her the opportunity to do something we've never seen her do. And that's amazing as a fan to kind of go, oh, yeah. And then you kind of put her on screen with Sydney, and that's kind of like, and then Fiona Shaw, and you're like, oh my God, this is the cherry on the cake. It's just, I'll tell you something that I've loved about what you've done. And I wanted to talk about Beast for a minute as well at some point, because I absolutely adored that film. It's just how you really bring out the best in your female talent. You really give them the opportunity to kind of really so much girth to their characters.
Yeah, I don't if it's I'm trying to think if it's something that I think of consciously, like I don't know if I have a gender interpretation when I'm reading a script. It's more, do you find the character interesting? Yeah, and it's great to hear that Julianne is doing something different from what you've seen of her, because she's done so much, so many seminal films, so much seminal work. But I think that's a testament to Brad's writing, that there's a kind of a character with a unique identity there. Like what I liked about this, especially for a thriller, is that, maybe in a more conventional thriller, there would be like one single problem the character's contending with. But with this, it's like everything's all happening all at once. The fraught relationship with her daughter, that she's grieving the loss of a partner, and that's kind of 9 months ago. So maybe her closest friends aren't calling her all the time, but for her, it's still extremely raw, that she's in a financially precarious situation, and that something about that felt true to life. Like, we've either been through it, or I know people close to me where it's all hit them at once, and life isn't as kind of elegantly parceled out as it is sometimes in a movie. And, maybe in a drama you would get that. I thought in a thriller, we've got a character who's struggling just to even get out of bed in the morning, considering what they're dealing with. And then if you throw in a character like Donal, when they're such a difficult place, I was like, that seemed exciting. So that maybe that's something that Julianne was also attracted to. Like, you could make a drama out of what her character is going through, but then to contend with all the things that are thrown at her, that felt unique. And maybe there is some kind of connection with what Jessie's character was going through in Beast. It wasn't just her relationship with Johnny's; it was also a toxic family dynamic, but the other way around. And half the movie was sort of focused on that. I remember thinking about that film almost like a Prison Break movie, and it's just the irony is that she needed a monster to help break her free. Yeah, there's something about family dynamics when people that are closest to you are cruel to each other. It's painful and compelling. I don't know why I'm attracted to it, because I grew up in a very loving household.
And Sydney as well, she's got this kind of really big ask of kind of playing a character, but playing a character within the character as well, in terms of acting within the character, if that makes sense. I mean, it's so good. Oh my God.
Yeah, how much these two women are kind of lying to themselves and lying to each
Each
other
other.
to try and maintain this relationship. And you kind of feel empathy for that. You know, for Julianne's character, it's like the only close family member she has in her life. So of course she wants to nurture and protect the remnants of a good relationship. But you're also watching someone get manipulated, maybe willfully manipulated. And then there's interesting questions of, well, is she being heroic for her daughter? Is this really noble of her? Or is she, you know, does her daughter have her like wrapped around her finger? And this, I don't know, it's kind of murky. It's kind of both things at once.
It's also terrifying to watch being a parent.
I'm not there yet, but yeah, someone did watch it and they said, this might put people off having children.
Oh my God. No, I think actually it's a good thing because it kind of makes you go, I need to be more honest and I need to have proper conversations, not just kind of like dance around things. It's like actually have conversations. And I love when you come away from a film being completely entertained, but also it kind of almost reflecting back on you and go, what are you going to take away from this experience? So I loved that about it. Really, really did. Really, really loved it. You mentioned the Jed responding to like the lake and stuff as well, but that whole kind of setting of particularly the farm, and so, I mean, it's so incredible. You kind of almost like, but again, that's a real character as well. That's almost kind of lying to us in a way. Where was it? Because it's beautiful.
It was in New Jersey. This film was set in Pennsylvania, but we had to shoot in New Jersey. And New Jersey gets a really bad rap. Like when I told some Americans, oh, I'm going to go to New Jersey, they were like, oh, that's the armpit of America. You're not going to
want that's where the boss is from. What are they talking about?
I know. I think because it's got some like tough cities.
Okay.
It looks like it didn't. But we were in a really beautiful part of it, just across from the Delaware River. And a lot of New Yorkers go out there to spend weekends and what do they call it? Go antiquing. So we were in this really quaint little town called Lambertville. So it was like summer camp, turning up to work every day. Like, you know, there's so many cute little bars and restaurants nearby. And it was like a retreat. But there is something, part of the reason we're attracted to that location is that there was something not spooky in a horror way, but it wasn't just quaint. We were a bit worried about having somewhere that looked too picture perfect, that it could look a bit bland on screen. So that was another thing that we were trying to find, was a location that had an atmosphere. And maybe that's, you know, I think that's also something Jed responded to as well, that it had many different faces, that farm.
It's a couple of years till the 10th anniversary of Beast. And I'm very much hoping that it gets like a cinematic re-release kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? That'd be great to see it back on the big screen. What's your kind of, when you think about Beast, what's the kind of strongest memory or the thing that kind of pops in front of your head when you think about that film?
I think working with Jesse and Johnny, but like it being her first movie and my first movie. And so we gave everything to it and it was her obsession, you know, for months and months leading up to it. And I remember, I think the crew member said to me, I was a bit like, I don't know, despondent because, you know, we hadn't shot something or the schedule had to move around and I found it a very tough shoot, you know, doing a film in 5 weeks and lots of locations. And I think the crew member said something like, you know, if this feels really hard now, you'll try and replicate this and probably won't ever get to this place again. I said, how do you mean? It's like, oh, well, just you and the actors and you're kind of working with people you're at film school. It's actually a special moment for you. And I kind of didn't sink in, but later, you know, as I've worked, I was like, oh, actually looking back, there was something kind of beautiful about that. And I don't know, maybe because it was also set on the island that I'm from and working with these actors that were kind of breaking into the industry, I think that feels special. So I watch it, and if it's released in 10 years I'll watch it again and maybe I'll be at peace with what the movie is, because I'm usually the worst audience member. If I rewatch any of my films, I end up
really
I'm like, why do we have that scene in? We should change that. That angle should be there. That's on the wrong lens. It's terrible. But maybe after a decade, I'll be like, okay, I'm fine.
You got 2 years, so let's have a nice sort of build up to it, and then we can get it. Yeah, get it. You can come and do a post Q&A. You could tell us everything you would have done, or we can just celebrate it for sure. What about the music on that one? I'm working with Jim Williams on music for Beast.
Yeah, it was a similar thing, I think, where he responded to the images. We didn't talk too much about the music before we'd made the film. And I think my pitch to him was that the music should come from like the guts of the character. Like it wanted to be a kind of subjective score from Jesse's character, from Marvel's perspective, as opposed to it trying to hit the beats of what we might think a psychological thriller is.
Listen, it's so lovely to get the chance to chat to you. Kind of
Likewise.
watched from afar with Admiral. I think I was at the Biffas that year as well, when kind of Beast sort of swept the board, and quite rightly so. But it's really lovely to get the chance to chat to you, and huge congratulations on this film. It's delivers so many great things as a film fan. So yeah, it's great to chat to you, Michael. Thanks for your time and
It's a lot.
congratulations.
Appreciate it, Edith.
From the score to Echo Valley, that's The Body. Rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with Michael Pierce.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Valspar Ultra starts at just $29.98 a gallon. So we've got you covered when your daughter wants to paint her room again after last year's masterpiece of a unicorn mural.
Dad, please.
Or when you realize that maybe you went too hard on the greige.
I miss color.
Or when you are sure you wanted a home gym, but your elliptical is currently hanging your laundry.
What about a home office?
Shop everything you need for your next phase with Valspar. Available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
My huge thanks to Michael for taking the time to talk to me. You can stream Echo Valley on Apple TV Plus now. And as I mentioned, watch this conversation on our YouTube channel, along with plenty more video content. What have we got up there? We've got loads of great stuff up there. You can go and watch Drew Wade, who's the cinematographer for The Bear. He was absolute quality, such a brilliant insight into that whole world. Stephen Leckhart, who's the director of the Stans documentary, the new Eminem doc, Dean Dubois, the How to Train Your Dragon director, Michael Patrick King, the creator and writer, showrunner of And Just Like That and Sex in the City. So loads up there. It'd be great if you could follow us on our socials. We're at Soundtrackin' UK. And as I said, please do feel free to send us an email. Just quickly on our socials as well, if you aren't already, please do go and follow us on Be In The Scene. We've had a really fun time this week where we put up a dance battle. That was to celebrate the upcoming release of The Life of Chuck, which I'll talk about in a second. It's a new film that stars Chiwetel Ejiofor, Tom Hiddleston, Karen Gillan, and there's the most bewildering, beautiful dance scene in the film. And so to celebrate the film, we really wanted to look back at some of our favourite dance scenes from films. So we have a dance battle up on the Be In The Scene socials. So just head over at Be In The Scene and you can get involved as well and help decide who the winner is. Next up, Tom Hiddleston and Chiwetel Ejiofor join me to discuss The Life of Chuck. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.